Welcome to our teaching series entitled The Boys of Summer. Today we're going to look at the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk tells a remarkable story that is relevant to who we are today. And I want to start before we get into the text, I want to set some background. As we've been working through the minor prophets, last time looking at the prophet Nahum, we haven't done these prophets in historically chronological order. We've just followed the Bible book order of the minor prophets. So we've had to jump around a little bit historically. So let me tell you where we are. With Nahum, we saw a prophecy of the destruction of Assyria. The Babylonians were on the horizon, and the empire that would eventually replace the Assyrians was in its early stages. Nahum is preaching to the Assyrians at the height of their power and talking about something absolutely stunning. He's talking about their destruction. Well, sure enough, we saw as Nahum's story unfolded, we saw that God did keep that prophecy. He kept his word. Assyria was destroyed by the new up-and-coming superpower of Babylon. As the sixth century begins, the seventh century BC is coming to a close, and the sixth century is beginning. What we have is a struggle for supremacy between Egypt and Babylon. Assyria is fading, and these two powers are beginning to vie for supremacy. In fact, Egypt was a fierce enemy of the Assyrians. And really, they were treated poorly at the hands of the Assyrian army. But as Babylon began to rise, the Egyptians formed an alliance with the remnant of Assyria to try and bolster their defenses against Babylon, which seemed to be the next threat. As this story unfolds, we have a pharaoh in Egypt by the name of Necho. Necho is leading the Egyptian assault with some Assyrian forces at his command against the Babylonians. In the process, as he advances across the map, he takes over for a short time the nation of Judah. He puts a puppet king on the throne of Judah and makes sure that a pro-Egyptian party is in charge of that nation. Judah was not an important nation militarily, except for the fact that its location was a real travel crossroads, if you will. It was an important area to control for armies to be able to move back and forth across that part of the world. The Egyptians put a puppet king there and then went to war with the Babylonians. In 605 BC, one of the great battles of ancient history took place. It's called the Battle of Carchemish. And at the Battle of Carchemish, the Babylonian Empire defeated the combined forces of Egypt and the remnants of the Assyrian army. As Nebuchadnezzar II, the commander of Babylonian forces, as he began to not only defeat Egypt, but as he began to pursue Egypt in their retreat, he pushed the Egyptian army all the way back into Egypt. And in the process, he laid claim to all the territory that had been under Egyptian control while he was winning that battle. So the Battle of Carchemish was 605. In about 604, Judah is removed from Egyptian influence and replaced with the Babylonians, who now lay claim to Judah. They didn't change the rulers of Judah, but they did demand loyalty. They demanded an oath of allegiance to the Babylonian Empire. Within a few years, though, the kings of Judah began to decide that Egypt was a better partner, and so they rebelled against Babylon. And in 600 BC, Nebuchadnezzar came to Judah and laid siege to Jerusalem for about a year and a half. He deposed the king and took his son into Babylonian exile and replaced him with the last king of Judah, who is a man by the name of Zedekiah. Zedekiah was loyal to the Babylonians and everything was in place. The Babylonian army withdrew. They didn't pursue the siege. They took the new leadership and left Judah pretty much intact until a few years later when Zedekiah betrayed his loyalty oath to the Babylonians, made overtures to the Egyptians for an alliance. Babylon returned to Judah and laid siege again in 588 BC. By 587 or the beginning of 586 BC, somewhere in that range, Nebuchadnezzar finally breaks through, tears down the walls of Jerusalem, destroys the temple, literally dismantles it, and takes the bulk of the population of Judah into exile. And that's where we come to the Babylonian exile. Jeremiah was a prophet during those days. He'd spent about 40 years prophesying that the Babylonians were going to come, that God was going to take his people out of the promised land for a time of discipline, but that he would maintain their identity and eventually bring them back. This is the period. Habakkuk is in this period writing. He probably was writing these words that we have sometime during that period of Egyptian domination, before Babylon had conquered Egypt, before they gained control of Judah, and certainly before the destruction of Jerusalem and the dismantling of the temple. The point is, in Habakkuk, unlike some of the other prophets, he is talking about judgment. He's talking about how God is manipulating world affairs to accomplish his purposes. But Habakkuk brings us to a consideration of a very interesting question. The first two chapters of Habakkuk are really a series of back and forth conversations between Habakkuk the prophet and God. And he's going to outline a concern that he has, and it's a concern that, frankly, every believer in every generation has had to struggle with. Habakkuk's initial concern in chapter 1 is, how can God allow evil to just have its way in the world? It seems like, and believers in every generation have faced this battle in their heads, it seems like more often than not, the bad guys win. In fact, we could go to the Psalms where we find David in that remarkable Psalm where he talks about how he almost lost his way because he was watching the evil of his day and it seemed like they were never punished. And then he says, but I considered their end. You see, what David had to learn was that you can only judge evil by looking a little further down the road. We look at our immediate circumstances. We deal with what we're seeing right before our eyes. David said God doesn't operate on our timetable. Well, Habakkuk, a century later, or more than that actually, Habakkuk is dealing with the same struggle. So his initial problem is, how can a good God let evil just seem to have its way in the world? Well, God is going to give Habakkuk an answer to his disturbing moral question. The problem is, the answer that God gives Habakkuk really throws him for a loop, because that creates a second, even more disturbing conclusion. And that is, how can God use evil to further his purposes? It's a fascinating little book, just three chapters, and I hope that you'll open your Bibles and go there with me. We're going to find in Habakkuk a great discussion of why evil exists and what God's relationship with evil is in the world. We're going to find some solid encouragement about how we live in a generation where it does seem like the bad guys win more than they lose. But we're also going to find in Habakkuk one of the great phrases, one of the great theological affirmations that shows up in at least three specific powerful moments in the New Testament. So Habakkuk makes a real contribution to New Testament theology by his struggle with this issue. In theological terms, we call it theodicy. Theodicy is simply a struggle with the problem of evil in the world. And so open your Bibles to Habakkuk, and we're going to start by looking at the problem of a sovereign God. Remember I said Habakkuk starts with a disturbing moral question, and God is going to give him a more disturbing answer, which produces for Habakkuk a still more disturbing conclusion. So work through the first chapter with me. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. The pronouncement that the prophet Habakkuk saw. Oh, by the way, I enjoy telling you what their names mean. Habakkuk is not a Hebrew word. It is an Akkadian word. That is a related Semitic language to Hebrew. But the best we can tell, Habakkuk means to have a grip, to have a solid grasp on something. And I don't think you'll find it too far of a stretch when you read this little book to see that Habakkuk was holding on for dear life because of this theological dilemma that he couldn't quite understand. But what he shows us that we need to learn is that when we don't understand, we don't turn away from God, we don't complain about God, we don't talk to other people about God. Like Habakkuk, the answer is to have a grip, a grasp on God that just won't let go. Here we are. The pronouncement that the prophet Habakkuk saw. How long, Lord, must I call for help and you do not listen? Or cry out to you about violence and you do not save? Why do you force me to look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Oppression and violence are right in front of me. Strife is ongoing and conflict escalates. This is why the law is ineffective and justice never emerges. For the wicked restrict the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. This is his initial problem that he takes to God. He says, how long? How long till something happens? I spend every day looking at the circumstances around me, looking at the situations that unfold, and it seems like the bad guys always win. Where are you? I cry out about the violence that's in front of me, and you don't show up to make things better. Listen, he's not just pouting. He's not whining. This is a deep-seated theological dilemma. He has an orthodox idea about who God is, about what the nature of God is. God is perfect. God is holy. God is just. God despises sin. And yet, you look at the circumstances of our day, and it's easy to come to the conclusion that God is at best an absentee landlord. He seems to not be all that interested. Things that are evil seem to go unchallenged. Man, America in 2020, does it not put a knot in your stomach that some of what we see doesn't even seem to be opposed by good? Churches don't know what they believe. Politicians have no backbone. We look at evil and we go, well, you know, what are you going to do? One of the leading politicians in our nation was recently asked about riots in the streets, burning buildings. And her response was, well, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. Really, that's the best we've got? That's the responsibility of those who are charged with law and order, those who should know the distinction between what is good and productive and what is evil. And Habakkuk takes this another step. He says, I've been betrayed by the politicians. The spiritual leaders have left me behind. But God, I don't see you in this equation either. Why do you force me to look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Oppression and violence are right in front of me. Strife is ongoing. Conflict escalates. He says the law is ineffective. It never does anything. Justice never emerges because the wicked restrict the righteous. The very systems of government are weighed against the righteous. The game is rigged in favor of evil. That's a serious question. And let me tell you something. If you've never struggled with that question, you're either not paying attention to the circumstances of our generation, or you've never come to know the nature of God as revealed in the Word of God, because what the Bible tells us about God and the apparent circumstances of our day seem to be at odds with each other. Habakkuk, we shouldn't throw rocks at Habakkuk. We shouldn't say, oh, now, don't talk that way. Be nice. God is God. Listen, you ever talk to somebody that's in a crisis? I mean, somebody that's hit rock bottom? Let me tell you the wrong answer to say to them at that moment. The wrong answer is to say, well, you know, God just does things different from us. You know, the only person that's satisfied by that answer is somebody that's not in the middle of a crisis. Yeah, I get it. God is God and I'm not. But why does evil seem to hold sway everywhere I look? Habakkuk's hit the nail on the head. It's a real problem. Well, sometimes we have to wait for God to answer questions like that. But Habakkuk gets an answer fairly quickly. Look at verse 5, God's answer. God says, look at the nations and observe. Be utterly astounded, for I am doing something in your days that you will not believe, that you will not believe when you hear about it. Look, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter, impetuous nation that marches across the earth's open spaces to seize territories not its own. They are fierce and terrifying. Their views of justice and sovereignty stem from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than wolves of the night. Their horsemen charge ahead. Their horsemen come from distant lands. They fly like eagles, swooping to devour. All of them come to do violence. Their faces are set in determination. They gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and rulers are a joke to them. They laugh at every fortress and build siege ramps to capture it. Then they sweep by like the wind and pass through. They are guilty. Their strength is their God. Now here's the answer. God gives him a disturbing answer. Habakkuk is looking around Judah and he says, I see corruption everywhere. Our politicians can't be trusted. Our spiritual leaders don't know what they believe. Evil wins. Good suffers. Innocents pay the price. Where are you, God? And God says this. Let me summarize. God says, Habakkuk, just watch, because you're going to see something amazing. Even now, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Now, let me tell you about that word. The Chaldeans were the primary people group that comprised the Babylonian Empire. The empire included a lot of different people groups, but the Chaldeans really emerged as the dominant people group. So by the days of Habakkuk, the term Babylonian and Chaldean had become synonymous. They were interchangeable terms. So he refers to Chaldeans here, God does, but it's the same as referring to the Babylonians. But here's God's answer. He says, I'm going to raise up this empire and I'm going to use them to judge the injustice of my people. It's as if he says, Habakkuk, just wait. I'm going to deal with Judah's injustice. I'm going to deal with those who have sided against me with wickedness. I'm raising up a nation right now to be used at my disposal to bring about my plans and purposes for the people of Judah, because my ultimate purpose of unfolding drama, the unfolding drama of redemption for the whole world, that will not be frustrated. But look how God describes the Chaldeans. There's a couple of interesting things. He says for one that they consider themselves sovereign. The Babylonian Empire was one of the great nation states of the ancient world as far as the implementation of laws. But for example, the law structure of the United States, our founding fathers built the structure of our judicial system, first of all, on the Ten Commandments, but second of all, on the concept of natural law. That laws come from God, they're revealed through nature, and the best governments are the ones who establish their legal system to reflect those laws rather than to pull in an opposite direction. The Babylonians didn't have that concept. For the Babylonians, there was no God that gave laws. There was no God with a nature that they needed to reflect. The world itself didn't operate. They viewed themselves as sovereign. They viewed their empire as the pinnacle of human achievement. They answered to nobody. So they made law codes, and they lived by a system of laws that were really legendary in the sense that it helped the expansion of the Babylonian empire, and it helped them keep that empire organized and structured. But the basis of the law was not that this is the way the world works, this is a reflection of who God is. The basis of their laws were simply, this is what we say. And conquered nations had to throw out whatever it was they believed, and they simply adopted whatever the Babylonians said. They viewed themselves as sovereign. He also says their strength is their God. In the same way the Assyrians before them had viewed themselves as unstoppable, invincible, undefeatable. The Babylonians absolutely inherited that. In fact, if anything, they were worse because they were so prideful. They had defeated the Assyrian Empire. They had crushed the Egyptian Empire. They were unchallenged for the term of the existence of that empire. And so the Babylonians, basically, the biblical testimony is the Babylonians measured everybody on the earth against themselves. They were the standard by which all things were evaluated, and they were so proud of their strength, their military might, that they had gods, but the gods were more mascots in Babylon than actual powers to be served. The Babylonians didn't see themselves needing any supernatural assistance. Well, Habakkuk had a real dilemma. Why does God let evil go unpunished? And God said, oh, no. Pay attention, Habakkuk, because I'm going to punish evil. You're going to see me do it. I'm raising up a nation right now. And this is where Habakkuk now has a worse problem. His first problem was, why is God leaving evil unpunished? God says, I'm not going to leave it unpunished. I'm going to punish it. That's what the Babylonians are for. But here's the worst problem. Habakkuk is going to come back and say, you're kidding me. I mean, for all of Judah's wickedness, they don't compare in the slightest with the evil coming out of Babylon. You're telling me that you're going to use a more wicked people to judge a less wicked people. And you're okay with that. You see, Habakkuk got the answer to his first question, which only raised a second question that was worse, that was harder to comprehend than the first one. God had given him his answer in chapter 1. And so in verse 12, Habakkuk continues the conversation. Are you not from eternity, Lord my God? My Holy One, you will not die. Lord, you appointed them to execute judgment. My rock, you destined them to punish us. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. So why do you tolerate those who are treacherous? Why are you silent while one who is wicked swallows up one who is more righteous than himself? You've made mankind like the fish of the sea, like marine creatures that have no ruler. The Chaldeans pull them all up with a hook, catch them in their dragnet, gather them in their fishing net, and that is why they're glad and rejoice. That is why they sacrifice to their dragnet and burn incense to their fishing net. For by these things their portion is rich and their food plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slaughter nations without mercy? Habakkuk says, God, you've got to be kidding me. You're telling me that the answer to my dilemma about evil is that you're going to use the Babylonians as an instrument of judgment? That doesn't make sense. If Judah needs to be judged, Babylon needs to be judged even more. Let me read you what a couple of different writers have written about this passage. One writer that I was reading this week says, a word is in order here about God, quote, raising up the Babylonians as the instrument of judgment. God is so great in his sovereignty, he is even able to use human sin for his own purpose. That was certainly the case here. Obviously, God was not responsible for the violence and cruelty practiced by the Babylonians. He did not inspire these attitudes and actions. Likewise, he did not force the Babylonians to assume the role of world conqueror. That was their own goal. In, quote, raising up the Babylonians, God allowed them to do what they themselves wanted to do, but he used it for his purposes. They considered themselves the creators of law by which everyone else must live. The Babylonians alone were to judge the affairs of humanity, for they acknowledged no higher law than themselves. Because the law originated in their own self-centeredness and arrogancy, they alone had rights. This is a different writer. He says, theodicy, this reference that I made earlier to the problem of evil, he says, theodicy is our attempt to defend God's goodness and sovereignty in the face of evil. Monumental evil, predatory evil, institutional evil, personal evil, historical evil, demonic evil. The key question is, how can a loving and all-powerful God allow such evil to exist, let alone flourish? Why Hitler? Why Stalin? Charles Manson? Idi Amin? Osama bin Laden? Why apartheid? Genocide? Homicide? Suicide? Why so many villains living in palaces? Why so many saints living in hovels? Why leukemia? Why spina bifida and scoliosis and toxic spores and meningitis and metal fatigue in trains and electric failure in planes and drunk drivers swerving across medians and killing innocents? Wait, God says. Be patient. It'll all work out in the end. But you see, that's what I tried to say earlier. That answer is infuriating in its vagueness and its seeming insipidness. The only people that are satisfied with that kind of an answer are people who don't need consolation, people who are not in the middle of a crisis. Habakkuk is living at a time in history when everything is up in the air. He remembers the Assyrians, but they're passing into history. He sees the Babylonians. He knows the ambitions of the Egyptians, and he's living in Judah, and he sees the Egyptian armies march past one way, then retreat back through their territory, and here come the Babylonians, and he sees kings replaced on thrones and assassinations and plots and rebellions. What he doesn't see is the victory of good. There's nobody to root for in this story. The Assyrians were legendary in their evil. The Babylonians are worse. The Egyptians, there's no hero there. The kings of Judah, after King Josiah, the last good king, after he's killed by the Egyptian Pharaoh, the last kings of Judah are political puppets. They have no spine. They have no sense of right or wrong. Habakkuk is living in a day surrounded by enemies and not finding any help. So he turns to God as the reasonable place to go in this situation. And God says, oh, I'm going to take care of the problems in Judah. I'm going to bring in the Babylonians. They're going to be my instruments of judgment. And Habakkuk says, I don't get that. God, how can you tolerate How can you even let the Babylonians exist on the planet in their arrogance, in their pridefulness, in their self-centered domination of the world? How can you let them even exist, much less use them as instruments to accomplish your righteous purposes? I don't want to downplay this. I don't want to soft pedal this dilemma. Habakkuk has hit the nail on the head. This is one of the great struggles for believers, for followers of the true God. This is one of the great mental misunderstandings that we can't quite get our mind around this problem. Well, so what does Habakkuk do? Well, he's been given this impossible explanation. There's a real temptation at this point, and I see it in this generation all the time. I have conversations occasionally with people who really feel justified that they can hold God accountable. Because as far as they can see, he's just not doing anything to fix this world. And so they turn away from him. They leave him in bitterness. They complain. They talk to others. They reject the faith. I get it. This problem of unjudged evil, it's a real dilemma. So what did Habakkuk do? Well, he had a problem because God was sovereign, but he's going to discover the perfection of that same sovereign God. Look at the first verse of chapter 2. This is, in fact, the first four verses of chapter 2 are really the climax of this little short book. So let me read these verses. Verse 1, I will stand at my guard post and station myself on the lookout tower. I will watch to see what he will say to me and what I should reply about my complaint. Now, I just want to spend a minute with chapter 2, verse 1. The problems, the two problems that are in chapter 1 are real, and they are not easy to solve. We have a lot of books in our generation that have been written to try and deal with this, but in my experience, they tend to be pretty hollow, vapid. Probably the one you've heard of is the one that was so famous. Why do bad things happen to good people? The conclusion of that book was particularly disappointing. The idea was God is good, but he's not all powerful. There's only so much he can do. He's doing the best he can. Cut him some slack. It's a tough problem. I mean, it's a lame response. I don't know that we can live with an answer that just says, well, you know, God is a kindly old man, but he really doesn't have the stuff in him anymore to deal with evil. That doesn't work. There are those who go to the other extreme and they say, well, God's responsible for everything. His sovereignty means nothing happens. He dictates the actions, the thoughts, the interactions of every human being on the planet. God is just moving chess pieces around, and none of us have any choices. It's all been predetermined. We are just playing out roles that have been assigned to us. We have no part in this. Yeah, I can't live with that either. That kind of hardened determinism, that God is like a child with some army men and he just moves them as he sees fit, and he just knocks them over and kills them just sort of randomly, and when he decides he just sets them up differently and he does it again. Yeah, that's not a good God. That's a God who doesn't have any connection whatsoever to the God that's presented in the Bible. So where do we land? I mean, how do we find the balance between God's good, but he's weak, versus God's strong, but he's bad? Well, here's what Habakkuk said. I'm going to go climb up on a guard tower. I'm going to be a lookout. And I'm going to stop my ranting until God gives me an answer. Instead of trying to figure this out, instead of coming to conclusions based on my limited understanding, my inability to see all the pieces and the parts, I'm going to wait for God to show himself. Now, at first glance, that may not sound that profound. But I think there's something deeply significant in the attitude of this man who has a real mental dilemma about the goodness of God, the morality of God allowing injustice to seemingly go unchecked and then using injustice to punish lesser injustice. But he doesn't abandon God. He doesn't throw up his hands in despair and walk away. He says, I'm gonna plant myself and I'm gonna stay put until I can hear from God. You know, it's kind of like after Job had issued his complaints about the way God was running his life. And when God finally met Job, he never gave Job an explanation. He never gave Job an answer. He simply gave Job an experience of his presence that was so overwhelming that Job says, okay, I'm going to shut my mouth now because I've been talking about things that I don't know anything about. I've been letting my mouth run when I really don't know. I'm too limited. I'm too finite to solve these great questions. But I've met God and he is so awesome, so majestic, so great, so holy, so pure, that at some point I have to just say, I don't know all the answers, but I trust God. That's where Habakkuk is going to take us. He says in verse 1, I'm just going to climb up on my tower and I'm going to wait for God to give me an answer. And here's the answer. Verse 2, the Lord answered me. Write down this vision. Clearly inscribe it on tablets so one may easily read it. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It testifies about the end and will not lie. Though it delays, wait for it, since it will certainly come and not be late. Look, his ego is inflated. He is without integrity, but the righteous one will live by his faith. Moreover, wine betrays. An arrogant man is never at rest. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and like death, he is never satisfied. He gathers all the nations to himself. He collects all the peoples for himself. Let me talk to you about this. The believer who listens will eventually meet the God who speaks. God came and he said, okay, write this down. I don't want you to forget it, and I want other people to be able to read it as well. Put it down on paper. Get it recorded. So that people can read it easily. The vision is yet for the appointed time. It testifies about the end, and it will not lie. Though it delays, get this, wait for it, since it will certainly come and not be late. God said, okay, here's what you don't understand, Habakkuk. You're looking at this moment in time, this historical moment. What I want you to understand is that I am standing outside of time. I'm apart from human history. And I have the big picture. And there is something unfolding here. And you can't see the whole picture. You're going to have to learn to live. Get this. Does this not sound like Evergreen? You're going to have to learn to live by seeing eternity. You can't always see. It's not always visible. Look at what he says. God comes to the prophet and he says, look, his ego is inflated. He is without integrity. He's referring back to Babylon. What God is saying is, listen, there's nothing about Babylon that I'm not aware of. You're disturbed because I'm using Babylon to bring judgment and discipline to my people, Judah. I want you to understand, Habakkuk, I know He says, he gathers all the nations to himself. He collects all the peoples for himself. And he's going to tell in the next few verses, we're not going to read all of them, but he's going to outline for Habakkuk what his plans are for Babylon. Babylon is not an instrument of God's judgment against Judah, and then they get to go off scot-free. In fact, if we go back to our historical timeline, 587, 586 BC, Judah is destroyed, the temple is destroyed, the city of Jerusalem is razed to the ground, the people are carried off, the prophecy was 70 years of discipline in exile, but what we have to remember historically is that God's word to Habakkuk comes true, because by 539 BC, before the end of the 70 years of exile, God has raised up a man by the name of Cyrus, who's king of the Persians, who will wipe Babylon off the map. God raises nations and he crushes nations. And in between the raising and the crushing, he uses them to further his purposes. Babylon ultimately, eternally has no value in human history except as an instrument in the hands of God for a very specific moment in time. And God used them to his purposes, and then he judged them for their wickedness. But he tells Habakkuk, you've got to have a perspective that is longer than the moment you're in. And this is what I want you to see. Go back again to verse 3 and verse 4. The vision is yet for the appointed time. What I'm going to show you isn't going to happen until a while passes. But I've already got it mapped out. It testifies about the end and it will not lie. Though it delays, wait for it, since it will certainly come and not be late. How do you wait for the unfolding purposes of God in human history? Here's the key. Verse 4. But the righteous one will live by his faith. Oh, man. Do you know that that verse is quoted in Romans chapter 1? The gospel is the power of salvation, first to the Jew and then to the Greek, because the righteous man lives by faith. Galatians chapter 3, Paul writes to the church in Galatia, and he says, remember, you don't give up the gospel. The righteous man lives by faith. The writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 10, says, get this, the sacrifice is complete. Jesus was the best priest. He was the best sacrifice. He fulfilled all the tenets of the law. Every requirement was satisfied. The only thing you have to do is to receive the gospel that comes through the work of Christ, and you, as a righteous man, then live by faith. Habakkuk is discovering a theme that carries us all the way through the New Testament, and that is, we never in any generation see the full story of God. We are just in one act. We're in one scene, in one act, in one play. It is a drama that started in the Garden of Eden when God said, I'll crush the head of the serpent and I will through the seed of the woman bring salvation. It started in the Garden of Eden. It finishes in the book of Revelation where Jesus is shown with nothing hiding his glory. We, at most, live 70, 80, 90, maybe 100, 105 years. At the most, we're a part of a story. We're a sliver of a story that spans millennia. And we say, well, God, I don't see you doing what I think you should be doing. I don't think evil should have sway. I don't think it should be in charge. I don't think the bad guy should win. And God says, they're not going to win. Wait for it. Live by faith. It's what you can't see that will forever determine the fate of what you can see. Well, what's he going to do with Babylon? Well, we're not going to read the rest of the second chapter, but there are five oracles. They're called oracles of woe. God gives five small sections. I'm just going to mention them to you. They're essentially announcements of judgment on Babylon for different crimes against humanity that they've committed. Let me just give you this list. You might consider it almost an inventory of their sins. They had insatiable greed, verses 6 through 8. They were marked by an impersonal exploitation of other human beings, verses 9 through 11. They had an ignorant tyranny over the nations, verses 12 through 14. Their culture was marked by incessant violence, verses 15 through 17. And they were known for their idolatrous worship, verses 18 and 19. In other words, God is coming to, he's coming to Habakkuk and he says, don't think anything they've done has slipped by me. I have an unfaltering grasp of who they are and what they've done. I have a record. Nothing has been missed. And he recites this inventory of sins. You can read these verses. It's a devastating description of a culture that answers to no God. And the true God says they answer to no God until they meet me. And they will answer to me. It will come in my time. The fate of the wicked and the fate of the righteous are not determined by evil men. God is unfolding human history. But I want you to see the closing verse of chapter 2. Chapter 2 started with Habakkuk saying, I'm going to go climb up in my tower and I'm just going to stay here silent until God gives me an answer. That's actually not a bad approach when we have arguments with God. Instead of checking with other people and seeing what they think, instead of talking bad about him behind his back, instead of rejecting him and walking away from the church, the people of God that he wants you to be a part of, it'd be good sometimes if we would just sit and be quiet and wait for God to show us in his word what his message is for us. That's where Habakkuk showed us the right way. I'm just going to sit here. I'm just going to wait for him to answer. God comes to him and outlines the bigger picture, bigger than what Habakkuk is able to see in his moment in time. And here's the conclusion of chapter 2. Verse 20, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the whole earth be silent in his presence. You see, in chapter 1, Habakkuk is consumed with what he's seeing all around him. He's caught up in the current events of his day, and they're bad, and it's killing his spirit. Sound familiar? America, 2020. We're obsessed with the latest tidbits of news. We're watching this ride and that ride and the rise and fall of this autonomous zone and this statue is torn down and the coronavirus is sweeping the globe and we just look at it and go, God, where are you? I can't manage like this. What if we went to our quiet place? And we open the Word of God and we say, I'm just going to stay here until God speaks to me. I think what will happen, sometimes it takes a minute, sometimes it takes a month. God doesn't come and answer us automatically. We have to seek Him. But the promise of the Word of God is to those who seek Him, He will be found. He's not playing hide and seek with us. I think the problem is most of the time when we come to God, we do all the talking. We issue our complaints. We lay out our requests. We tell him what we think he should do. We tell him how he should act in this situation, that situation. The model of Habakkuk here is coming into the presence of the Lord and just being quiet. The one who lives by faith is the one who says, I'm going to live by what I can't see. And so I'm going to wait for what I can't see to make itself known to me. And as God shows up and reveals his plans to Habakkuk, the end of the chapter is Habakkuk saying, guess what? I didn't know where God was because I was looking at all the circumstances, the riots in the streets and the statues toppling down and all the stuff that's going on around me. But he said, when I got quiet and when I sought out the Lord, guess what I found out? He's not absent. He's seated on his throne and he hasn't moved from that space. Nothing that has happened in Habakkuk's generation, nothing that's happened in our generation has caused God to topple off of his throne. He is seated in a place of power. He is sovereign over human history. And Habakkuk said, the world would be a lot better place if everybody would just be quiet before his presence. Wow. It's exactly what Job discovered. Job didn't have explanations to the problem, and I don't know that really Habakkuk walks away with any complete sense that all of his questions have been answered, but he has walked away with this certainty. God has not toppled from power, so it's going to be okay. Verse 20 has a kind of finality to it. The moral God is on his throne. It is his government that controls the world. The righteous stand before him to the permanence of their faithfulness. The wicked who have rejected him for non-gods, they are facing a terrible destiny. This is the answer to Habakkuk's crisis of faith. Recognize that God is bigger than us. His ways different than ours. His timetable beyond the span of our lives. And while we may say, I'm living at a particularly distressing moment in human history, nothing that happens in the year 2020 stops what's coming at the conclusion of human history and the introduction of eternity. The King always wins. Well, chapter 3 is Habakkuk's final prayer, really. It's his conclusion. I just want to give you a couple of verses from this chapter and we'll wrap up. Chapter 3 verse 1 says, a prayer of the prophet Habakkuk according to Shiganot. I'll talk about that word in just a minute. Lord, I have heard the report about you. Lord, I stand in awe of your deeds. Revive your work in these years. Make it known in these years. In your wrath, remember mercy. Now, basically chapter 3 is a psalm, a hymn, if you will. It's a poem set to music. There's that interesting word, and it's interesting that the English Bible doesn't translate this word into English. Whenever that happens, whenever you see a word that's not translated, it's generally because the translators just don't have enough information to know how to translate it. There's really a couple of different arguments for this word. It says, a prayer of the prophet Habakkuk according to Shiganot. There is one school of thought that says that this word, also, by the way, not a Hebrew word. It's an Akkadian word, which is part of why it's so difficult to translate, because we don't have a lot of Akkadian literature that we can draw from. But one school of thought says this is a certain kind of music. It's almost like a dirge or a funeral song. And so they think, the theory is that Habakkuk may have been one of the priests in charge of worship in the temple, because this would imply that he has some sort of musical background, and that as he goes through his struggle in the first two chapters, his moral dilemma about God and evil, he gets to the third chapter and writes a dirge, a poem set to music to communicate the confidence that comes because he's discovered that God has not fallen off of his throne. He's still sovereign in the universe. Maybe that's right. There's another school of thought that simply says it's an Akkadian word that means ignorant, stupid. I can go either way, because if that's what it means, then we would translate it this way. A prayer of the prophet Habakkuk written out of his ignorance. What did Job say after he had encountered God? I'm not going to talk anymore. I've been talking about stuff I don't know anything about. You see, when you have an encounter with the true God, when you are overwhelmed by who he is, you find yourself with Job saying, I'm going to shut up now because I really don't know what I'm talking about. You find yourself with Isaiah, who meets God and says, I'm a man of unclean lips. I can't speak in the presence of this God. You find yourself in the company of Habakkuk, who says, I'm going to tell you what little I know, but understand this comes out of my ignorance because I don't know nearly as much as I used to think that I know. Well, what does he know? He knows this prayer, and this is one of the great prayers, one of the great prayers of the Old Testament. He says, Lord, I've heard the report about you. I stand in awe of your deeds. Revive your work in these years. He then says, in your wrath, remember mercy. I think if there's any of the eight minor prophets that we've looked at so far this summer, we may have just discovered the content of the prayer that we need to pray in the summer of 2020 for the United States of America. And that prayer is, Lord, do it again. Show yourself mighty among the people of this nation in ways that you've not done in a very long time. We've read the stories of the first great awakening. We know the accounts of the second great awakening. We can speak about the Finney revivals of 1830, the 1830s. We can talk about the great prayer awakening of 1857 and 58. We can talk about the Azusa Street revivals in 1906. But guess what? We haven't seen spiritual awakening in this country in over 100 years. Lord, do it again. Revive your work. If we'd spend half as much time crying out to God for spiritual awakening that we spend fretting and watching the news and wringing our hands and worrying about what comes next, if we would sit silently and say, Lord, I've read the stories of your work. I've heard the tales of what you've done. Lord, revive your work in my generation. Lord, do it again. But then he says this, the prophet who started in chapter 1 saying, how long till you judge these people? How long till this injustice is taken care of? I hear a lot of Christians in 2020 with that attitude. God, how long till you just wipe these idiots off the face of the earth? And yet look at his prayer by the time he gets to chapter 3. He says, do it again. Revive your work in these years. In your wrath, remember mercy. This is a different man praying in chapter 3 than we heard praying in chapter 1. This is a guy who says, God, I know you're going to deal with injustice. You're going to deal with wickedness. You're going to confront evil. Lord, when you come into my generation to confront evil, remember that mercy is in your nature. Don't let your wrath come without your mercy. What do you think would happen to change our hearts if we quit praying that God would destroy all these idiots that are irritating us and started saying, God, I know that you're going to deal with this. You've got the big picture in hand. You are a God that doesn't let evil go unchallenged. I know that's coming. I've heard the stories. I've seen your works. But Lord, from my perspective, when you come in wrath, bring mercy. Folks, this is our prayer. This is what we've led up to in 8 weeks this summer. We've finally found the prayer. Habakkuk tells us the righteous man lives by faith. He lives by the invisible. And his prayer is, Lord, I've heard the stories of your great works. Do them again in my generation. And when you come in judgment, bring mercy with you. Well, the last verse of the chapter simply says this: the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like those of a deer and enables me to walk on mountain heights. The Lord, my Lord, is my strength. I don't know about you, I just know about me. But as I've worked through these minor prophets this summer, sometimes I just feel like I'm taking a body blow because the judgment, the punishment, the expectation of national penalty, it just weighs on me. And I can't stand the thought of where this country is headed. But then, praise Jesus. Really, at just the right time for my soul, I got to Habakkuk. Lord, I've heard the report about you. I stand in awe of your deeds. Revive your work in these years. Make it known in your wrath. Remember mercy. I'm committing to make that my prayer for the rest of 2020. I'm going to add that at the top of my list of things that I pray about. Habakkuk and his insight that the righteous man lives by faith, his prayer for God to do it again, and when he comes in judgment to bring his mercy. I think those things are going to allow me to say, He makes my feet like those of a deer and enables me to walk on mountains high. Folks, do not despair. This story that we're a part of, it ain't over. And we win. Praise the Lord. God bless you.